This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We are part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast. Simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone and search for DC 37 State of the Union. And for DC 37 members and those who are interested in our work, there are now more ways to stay in touch with us. You can follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Check out our website, www.dc37.net. And call the hotline for news about events and other union happenings, 212-815-7555. If you have any comments about our show, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Your feedback is always welcome. Tonight, we are discussing the state of the public housing in our city. And joining us by phone to discuss this and other issues is the City Council's Committee on Public Housing Chair, Alika Samuel. Welcome to the show.
Good evening, Chris. How are you?
I am good. You are a former DC 37 member. It always makes us feel great to know that former DC 37 members are also, you know, taking part in the city's governing process.
That's what we do. Proud member of Local 371.
The mighty SSEU 371.
Absolutely.
And you were working for the city, and what was your, what did you do for the city?
I was an ACS Child Protective Specialist. That's the Administration for Children's Services. And I was one of those individuals that would go out and investigate allegations of child abuse and neglect, not just in the homes, but also in daycare centers and anywhere where a child was supposed to be safe. I had the duty and just the job responsibility of going out to make sure that our young children, our babies are protected.
That must be an awesome responsibility, caring for the city's children in who are in facilities and the like.
Absolutely. They're our most vulnerable citizens, and at the same time, they're our future. And so if the parents and the teachers and everyone else with the responsibility of caring and, educating them and protecting them are maybe not doing it, there's other people that are, have that direct responsibility, and that was the work is of ACS, in particular Child Protective Specialists. So just shout out to all the CPS workers out there who are doing an amazing job and don't necessarily get the credit that they deserve.
And you represent East New York and Brownsville?
Actually, I represent Brownsville and Ocean Hill and parts of Bed-Stuy, Crown Heights, and East Flatbush.
And what
41st district?
The 41st council district. And now you are the chair of the public housing committee on the city council. And there has been a lot of talk and a lot of problems with the city's public housing. What is the current status of the situation at the New York City Housing Authority?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just first say that not only am I the chair of the Public Housing Committee in the New York City Council, but I'm a proud product of public housing. I grew up in NYCHA. And so when you ask what's the state of NYCHA today, of course there's this dire need for capital repairs. And, NYCHA talks about a $25 billion capital needs budget right now. But at the same time, I don't want the public to forget that you have amazing and strong people who live in public housing, who go to work every single day, who are our city employees, who are members of DC 37, every single day going out there and helping to move the city along. But at the same time, when they come home to some serious needs. There's a lot of lead issues in our units, as well as mold issues. And I know a lot of people heard about the heat and hot water crisis that happened during our winter months. And there's a lot of needs and concerns and hazardous conditions. And right now, NYCHA needs every dollar they can possibly get from the city, the state, and the federal government. And that's where we are today. Now, the problem has been recognized because of the media, because of all of the hearings that were held at City Hall, and because of all the rallies and press conferences. And we're in a great place because of all of the attention. But now it's really about moving that money along and through the system so that the families can get those repairs addressed immediately.
You know, the NYCHA housing stock, I mean, if you go to any other city in the country, like I've been to every other city in the country, but I certainly know that when I've been to other cities, and I'm always stunned by when you see what's not in other cities, you realize how ambitious the New York City has been in trying to create this much public housing and to be able to make it. There are plenty of problems with it. But when you take a step back and you realize what it is we have tried to accomplish, it's quite awesome a task.
It really is.
And the amount of housing that there is, and how you maintain that, and how you keep that going. Again, as you say, our members live and work within the public housing system. Talk a little bit about the size of our housing stock and what needs to be done.
NYCHA, New York City Housing Authority, is the largest public housing authority in the country. And in my district alone, I have 26 developments. I have the highest concentration of public housing in North America. And we have 175,000 units and some close to 500,000 people that live in public housing. And this is true traditional affordable housing, meaning that those public housing units are based on your income. So if you make $10,000, then your rent will be a third of $10,000, that annual salary. And there's no real true subsidies when you're looking at, when you're talking about Section 8 units, that could be, the unit could be $1,800, and the city will get a certain amount of money for that. Like the rent that is collected from residents in public housing is what public housing, the authority has in order to really be able to operate their buildings. And, you do get some funding from the federal government, but it's not to the level to be able to actually sustain what's needed in public housing. And so we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. That's on record.
Right.
And we know that our families double up and triple up sometimes in this particular housing crisis that we're living in now, especially. And so that's just a lot of people and a lot of developments, and in some areas, in serious concentrated areas. And it's not just having to do paint jobs and fix broken sinks and broken toilets and leaks. We're talking about security systems and, having to go in and out of buildings that the doors are wide open. And we're talking about developments that have only seniors. In my district, I have buildings and developments that are exclusively for seniors only. And that's a different level of care and concern. So there's just a lot of need and a lot of issues. But again, the focus right now is on these families for the first time in decades. There's been a disinvestment in public housing across the country. And so that's why we are where we are today, because of the lack of investment that's been coming into the buildings. But again, we have $550 million that was allocated from the governor. This mayor, de Blasio, he's put in a lot of, millions of dollars for repair needs. There was some $1.4 billion allocated for roof repairs and new roofs. So the attention is there. It's just a matter of making sure that the money moves in a more efficient manner, expeditiously.
Now, when were you elected to the city council for the first time?
I started January 1st.
That's what I thought. That's why. And I always ask this question when I have an elected official on. How did you make that decision? How did you make the decision to enter public service?
Because of a need. So I've always, like I told you, I worked for ACS.
Yes.
But I also worked for the mentally ill homeless with Goddard Riverside. I was a case manager doing direct impact, direct street team engagement. And I also worked with seniors. I worked in hospitals. I've always had this passion to work in a social service-oriented field and be able to be a resource to the most vulnerable and some of the most marginalized individuals in our society. And so after 2016 elections, I yes. realized there was an even greater need for me to do more than just work in the field and be an advocate. In fact, I was working at New York City Housing Authority when I made a decision to run for public office. And there's just a need for people that care, people that are educated, people that come from these communities to step up and be the leaders in the communities where they were born and raised. And if we didn't learn anything after 2016, we learned that our voices are necessary and we need to be heard and we need to do something about it now. And so I decided to run for office.
So the election of November 2016 was a motivating factor in your own decision?
Absolutely.
And how is it different from being a city employee to a public official?
As a city employee, the work that you do is governed by the policies and legislation and rules that are in place. And if you're, you know, a worker every day on the front lines and you see something that should be changed, there's not a lot that you can do because of the bureaucracies related to it. But as an elected official, especially someone who was on the front lines at one point, you know the issues that the workers are having in the field, or you know the issues that your families are having in schools or in the hospitals or in public housing, and you're able to actually sit in a place where you can be a change maker, be a lawmaker, a policymaker, and move the agenda along. And this time you're doing it with a strong voice and your colleagues to actually make a difference and change some of those policies that you saw were needed in the past. So it's totally different now because this time I'm at the table.
This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show. I'm Chris Policano. We're talking to Councilmember Alika Samuel. She represents the 41st District in Brooklyn, and she is the chair of the Council's Committee on Public Housing. And she's a former city employee and a former DC 37 member. And, you know, it is so important as we talk about from a union perspective and what the value of public employee unions are across the country. It is so important since so many decisions are being made, clearly in city councils and in state legislatures, that members and employees, people who, as you just said, know the situation from a very personal perspective, get involved with the political process.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I just have to do this one plug. There are 11 women that are elected to the New York City Council out of a 51-member body, meaning there are 51 members of the New York City Council and only 11 of us are women. But in New York City alone, there's over 400,000 more women than men. And so why is it that there's only 11 of us? So in the next election in the New York City Council is in 2021. And I am working extremely hard to make sure that we get more women elected to the New York City Council. And we have an initiative called 21 and 21, and that's an aggressive agenda to elect 21 women to the New York City Council in 2021. And I know that there are some great union women out there who can do this same job, and I'm looking for them and ready to work with them to get them elected to office.
Before we let you go, the priorities of the city council under the new speaker, what do you see the two or three biggest issues? Obviously, public housing is one of them, but what else would you put on that list?
In addition to public housing, you know, we also are going through this criminal justice reform, and we have this mandate to close Rikers Island, as well as the mandate of raise the age, getting our 16 and 17-year-olds off of Rikers Island by October 1st. So that's a huge piece of our agenda as well, to make sure that we want, you know, be able to abide by this new law, this mandate, but do it in the right way. And also, Fair fares is a huge issue, and fair fares meaning that we have so many New Yorkers that are unable to go to work, go to school, or go to see their doctor, or just move throughout the city of New York because they can't afford the fare. They can't afford to get on the subway or the bus. And, you know, we said that a turnstile should be a gateway into society. It should not stop you from being able to be a real part of the city. And so fair fares is a huge piece of the agenda moving forward because it speaks directly to the true New Yorkers who are out here every day just wanting to work and provide for their families. And it feels like the city is hindering them.
Alika Samuel, council member from the 41st Council District in Brooklyn, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, bye-bye.
And we'll be back after this.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today, 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union on the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. We're also available as a podcast. You can go to your smartphone and just search DC 37 State of the Union. Joining us now is someone who's been on this show many times before, the head of the mighty SSEU Local 371, President Anthony Wells. Brother Wells, welcome back.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me.
So I'm looking at a newspaper story that says that the city is looking to hire 200 youth development specialists. Those are your members, correct?
Yes, they are. They will be in the.
And I wanted to talk to you about how, you know, let's talk this whole issue about what we are going to do with these youth development specialists, what the goal of the jobs are, and also about the ongoing project to move folks from Rikers Island to other juvenile detention centers. So what has been agreed upon with the city?
Well, what's been agreed upon has been the establishment of this title, which is really a successor title to the juvenile counselor title. Okay, it what it does is seeks to attract and retain people. There's additional duties, additional focus, and obviously there's some additional money. The salaries are different than the previous title. All this came about, Chris, because last year the governor signed into law raised the age legislation, which effectively stopped charging juveniles as adults. New York State and North Carolina were the only two states left in this country that charged 16 and 17-year-olds as adults, and as of October 1st, that practice will end.
And what are the practical concerns that you have about that?
Well, there are many. The biggest one right now is that New York City is required by October 1st to remove all 16-year-olds from Rikers Island, and by 2019 to remove all the 17-year-olds. And what this does is says that they will be no longer be on Rikers Island, and I don't think the city will be prepared with the best program it can have because of this implementation date. This has been a problem for us. We have concerns about safety. We have concerns about programs. Our sister union, Colbert, Correctional Officers Benevolent Association, and I believe the Captains Association and the W. Wardens have filed a lawsuit which stopped them from going into the juvenile facility, which the city wants to do on October 1st.
Now, your concern is that this is that October 1st is just a few months away and that there needs to be more planning and more care given to how this program is implemented or this is implemented?
Well, yes. Well, that's one of the concerns. But for example, they're just now going to begin to hire workers for the youth development specialists, which is going to take time to, one, they have to be hired, obviously. They have to be vetted in terms of criminal background checks, child welfare background checks. And then there's a training. And we want to see a intensified training period, which would also include training by the Department of Corrections. And so you're talking about less than 120 days to implementation. This presents a serious challenge. What the city has offered is to have COBRA members and captains go into the juvenile facility and actually effectively have the Department of Corrections run the facility, which is arising in the Bronx, move the present population to Brooklyn, to our Crossroads location, and have DOC effectively run Horizons, which would effectively make it, to me, a mini Rikers.
Has there been a counter idea proposed to the city about what to do about that? Or is I'm just wondering what the solution would be, or if you're just simply saying we need more time to come up with the right solutions.
So the president of the Correctional Officers Union has offered a proposal to use the barge, which is located in the Bronx. And by doing that, then they can go in. So the question is, can correctional officers go into a juvenile facility? They deal with adults or those who are charged as adults. So by using the barge, that question would be removed, and also give our new workers a chance to actually train with correctional officers and make the transition better. So that's, in our view, a good proposal. What we've been asking for, and so has the probation officers union, that they extend the date, move the date back, and may require some work on the state level, but people are not really into doing that, and I'm not so sure the city is either. But if they talk to you off the record, they understand that October 1st presents so many challenges, including the court system, which may not be ready October 1st to address this population. Like I said, there are safety issues, there are programmatic issues that need to be addressed, and to do it correctly, you want to do it and have more time to do it. And October 1st doesn't present that.
Looking, and I understand, and I think you've made it very clear that this deadline does not work this, 90 days, 120 days, whatever it is between now and October 1st is too short a period of time. But looking a little bit beyond the immediate issue to the whole idea of how we deal with 16s and 17-year-olds in the city and what the role of these youth development specialists would be, is this a move in the right direction in terms of how we work with our city's kids in trouble?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, this is a long time coming. They raised the age, which, by the way, we all support. All the unions support it. Okay, its time has come. It's overdue, and you need to work to develop some of these young people, give them opportunities because they're going to most likely return to the community.
Right.
And you want them best prepared to return to the community. So yeah, this is it. Along with some other programs that they have. You can actually cut down the population. Now, there are some heinous things going on. Okay, let's not act like this is there's not some serious crime being committed, and that has to be dealt with also. But because they're young people, you have a chance to help them turn their life around sooner than later. And the youth, first of all, our juvenile counselors have been doing this for 40 years.
Right, right.
So our focus is a little different. Okay, our focus also deals with interacting with the residents more so than you would in an adult prison. Okay, the jobs are a little different. So while we're also concerned with security, we're also directly responsible for assisting in the development of the residents that we have in the juvenile facilities. So this is definitely a step in the right direction. You can't you know, treat 16, 17-year-olds like adults in one system that's punitive, and any place else, you said they're juveniles. They need to be treated as juveniles.
But there is a difference. I mean, forgive me for not knowing the nuances of this, but there clearly is a difference between nonviolent crimes and violent crimes committed by young people, right? So that's taken into consideration as this program moves forward and where they're placed. Is that correct?
No, it's not, because that's for the judicial system to decide what the punishment is for their crimes. We're just responsible for when they come through the door. So you're going to have a mixture of people who are charged with murder, charged with attempted murder, charged with crimes from drug dealing or gang activities. They're all going to be in the same location. That's there now. We have 14 and 15-year-olds charged with some of the most serious charges. Okay, so that doesn't change. So it's not going to be separated in terms of where they're held.
Okay.
By the nature of the crime. No, that doesn't happen.
I'm curious as to whether or not you think that should be.
From a social work standpoint, no.
Okay.
No. I think what you need is a fair and equitable judicial system, which would apply correct penalties to the nature of the crime. But once they enter into a facility where they're being held, and then this is just a holding, this is not where they're going to serve their time overall, for the most part. There are going to be some people who will, short-term people by the nature of the judicial system, backlog and processes. But no, I don't think so. I think we need to address their crimes as part of their development. And I believe that our members, not just the YDSs, but the social workers that we represent, the case managers that we represent, people who interact with this resident population need to take that into account when it comes to terms of treatment and try to help their development.
Anything else? We've only got about 40 seconds left. Is there anything else that I should have asked you about this issue that you wanted to make a point on? Because I really want to make sure that our listeners get to hear what's happening with this.
No, you made the point. I just want to make the point again that if you're in the interest of doing a program correctly, making this monumental change, and you want to put in the best interest of the resident, then you would move the October 1st date back. Okay? Unfortunately, part of this is getting caught up in the politics going on between the state and the city, and someone not wanting to blink. We believe, and the other two unions believe, that if you do this correctly, you have a better chance of success. And what is the success? The development and the care of our residents, of our young people. And that's what I want to push, and that October 1st does not present that in the most optimum way. Or in an alternative, utilize COBRA's proposal to use the barge as an intermediate.
Anthony Wells is the president of the Mighty Mighty SSEU Local 371. I want to thank you for joining us and for explaining this complicated issue.
Thank you, Chris, for the opportunity, and always we support you, and go Union, go.
Go Union, go. That's about all the time that we have. The engineer is Andrea Minocchio. The producer is Rudy Orozco. I'm Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.